climatic catastrophes, which piled thousands of feet of ice on the higher latitudes of the continents, also covered the oceans with icebergs and ice fields at lower latitudes and chilled the surface waters even down to the equator. Volcanic catastrophes cast rains of ash over the sea. This ash is preserved in the sedimentary bottom of the oceans. Tectonic catastrophes raised or lowered the ocean bottom hundreds and even thousands of feet, spreading huge tidal waves which destroyed plant and animal life on the coastal plains. At many places, such as the coast of Sweden, the bottom of a sea proved to consist of a lava bed of geologically recent origin, covered only by a thin veneer of sediment. The sediments of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, which often bore particles of volcanic material, also testify to the importance of volcanism in submarine geology. Some of our cores from the Mediterranean were marked with coarse, grained layers consisting largely of volcanic ash that had settled on the bottom after great volcanic explosions. These layers are an unrivaled record of the irregular volcanic activity of the past. The oceanic floor all around the globe bears witness that the oceans of the Earth were the scenes of repeated violent catastrophes when flows of lava and volcanic ash covered the precipitously rising or falling bedrock and tidal waves raced against continents. The bottom of the seas and oceans also contains evidence that the Earth was showered with meteorites on a very large scale. In many places the bottom consists of red clay. Samples of the red clay from the Central Pacific showed a surprisingly high content of nickel, and also a high content of radium, though the water of the ocean is almost completely free of these elements. The red clay is red because it contains ferruginous iron compounds. Meteoric iron differs from iron of terrestrial origin in its admixture of nickel, and it is this characteristic that makes it possible to differentiate iron tools of early ages, for instance of the Pyramid Age in Egypt, and to decide whether iron pieces were smelted from ore or were worked meteorites. Nickel is a very rare element in most terrestrial rocks and continental sediments, and it is almost absent from the ocean waters. On the other hand, it is one of the main components of meteorites. Thus it is assumed that the origin of the abysmal nickel was in meteoric dust or the very heavy showers of meteors in the remote past. The principal difficulty of this explanation is that it requires a rate of accretion of meteoric dust several hundred times greater than that which astronomers, who base their estimates on visual and telescopic counts of meteors, are presently prepared to admit. In a later publication, a popularized account of the Albatross expedition, Pettersson writes, assuming the average nickel content of meteoric dust to be 2%, an approximate value for the rate of accretion of cosmic dust to the whole Earth can be worked out from these data. The result is very high, about 10,000 tons per day, or over 1,000 times higher than the value computed from counting the shooting stars and estimating their mass. In other words, at some time or times there was such a fall of meteoric dust that, apportioned throughout the entire age of the ocean, it would increase a thousandfold the daily accumulation of meteoric dust since the birth of the ocean. The ash and lava on the bottom of the oceans indicate catastrophic occurrences in the past. Iron and nickel point to celestial showers of meteorites, and thus possibly also to the cause of the tectonic ruptures, of the collapse of the ocean floor and of the outbursts of lava under the surface of great oceanic spaces. Evidence of great upheavals has been brought forth from the islands of the Arctic Ocean and the tundras of Siberia, from the soil of Alaska, from Spitsbergen and Greenland, from the caves of England, the forest bed of Norfolk, and the rock fissures of Wales and Cornwall, from the rocks of France, the Alps and Juras, and from Gibraltar and Sicily, from the Sahara and the Rift of Africa, from Arabia and its Haras, the Kashmir slopes of the Himalayas, and the Siwalik Hills, from the Irrawaddy in Burma and from the Shenzhen and Chukchen deposits in China, from the Andes and the Altiplano, from the asphalt pits of California, from the Rocky Mountains and the Columbia Plateau, from the Cumberland Cave in Maryland and Agate Spring Quarry in Nebraska, from the hills of Michigan and Vermont with skeletons of whales on them, from the Carolina coast, from the submerged coasts and the bottom of the Atlantic with its ridge, and the lava bottom of the Pacific. with many other places in various parts of the world we shall deal in some detail in the pages that follow, but we shall not exhaust the list, for there is not a meridian of longitude or a degree of latitude that does not show scars of repeated upheavals. Chapter 8, Poles Displaced. The cause of the Ice Ages. One after the other, scenes of upheaval and devastation have presented themselves to explorers, and almost every new cave opened, mountain thrust explored, undersea canyon investigated, has consistently disclosed the same picture of violence and desolation. Under the weight of this evidence, two great theories of the 19th century have become more and more strained, the theory of uniformity and the theory of evolution built upon it. The other fundamental teaching originating in the 19th century, the theory of ice ages, has been loaded more and more heavily with the responsibility for the geological facts revealed. However, the cause of the ice ages remained a much discussed and never agreed upon subject. The origin of the glacial periods was sought on the earth below and in the heaven above. The theories that endeavor to explain what caused them fall under the following headings: astronomical, geological, and atmospherical. In the first group, some theories seek the cause of the ice ages in space, some in the sun, some in the relative positions of the sun and the earth. One idea was that the space through which the solar system traveled was not always of equally low temperature, the variations being due to gases or dust present in some areas. This idea has been abandoned. Another theory was that the sun is a variable star emitting more heat at some periods and less at others. This theory also failed to be substantiated and was generally rejected, yet sporadically it finds new proponents. Still another theory would have the ice ages arrive when a hemisphere, the northern or the southern, happens to have its winter while the globe is at the farthest end of its ellipse, as the southern hemisphere is at present. The winter would be a little longer and colder, however, the summer, though a bit shorter, would be hotter. And if the Earth always traveled on its present orbit, the described variations would not bring about an ice age. It was also claimed that the terrestrial orbit becomes alternately more and less stretched. Of the geological group of theories, one supposed a change in the activity of warm springs, another, a change in the direction of the Gulf Stream, which carries water warmed in the Caribbean Sea to the northern Atlantic, if there were no Isthmus of Panama, and North and South America were separated, a part of the stream from the Caribbean would flow into the Pacific. Both these theories were shown to be inadequate, and the paleontological survey of sea fauna on both sides of the isthmus suggests that the dividing strip of land existed long before the advent of the Ice Age. Another geological theory, which still has some adherents, sees the origin of the glacial periods in the changing altitude of the continents, which would also influence the direction of winds and precipitation. But it is definitely opposed by such an authority on glacial geology as A.B. Coleman, Professor Emeritus of Geology at Toronto University. When one considers the distribution of ice sheets in the Pleistocene, covering 4 million square miles of North America and half as much of Europe, and the ice in Greenland, Iceland, Spitsbergen, the southern island of New Zealand and Patagonia in South America, it becomes evident that all parts of the world could not have been elevated at once. The theory breaks down of its own weight. Therefore, elevation above snow line would cause local glaciation, but there is no evidence that large-scale ice sheets can be formed in this way, and that a universal refrigeration, like that of the Pleistocene, could be produced thus is manifestly impossible. Of the atmospheric conditions that could affect a rise or drop in temperature, the varying quantity of carbon dioxide in the air and also of dust particles was called on to explain the changes in temperature in the past. With the diminution of the carbon dioxide content in the air, there would be a fall in the temperature, but it was demonstrated by calculation that this could not have been sufficient to cause the ice age. If the Earth were enveloped in clouds of dust that kept the rays of the sun from penetrating to the ground, there would be a fall in temperature. However, one would have to explain where such extensive and thick clouds of dust in the atmosphere could come from. Scores of methods of accounting for ice ages have been proposed, and probably no other geological problem has been so earnestly discussed, not only by geologists but by meteorologists and biologists, and yet no theory is generally accepted. A true theory of the origin of ice ages, whether resorting to astronomical, geological, or atmospheric causes, must also explain why ice ages did not occur in northeastern Siberia, the coldest place on Earth, but did occur in temperate latitudes, and in a much more remote past in India, Madagascar, and equatorial Brazil. None of the theories mentioned explains these strange facts. Hypotheses concerning warmer and colder areas in space, or the variability of the sun as a source of energy, are especially inadequate to account for the geographical distribution of the ice cover. Thus, the concept of ice ages, which is established in science as one of its most definite facts, serving also as a foundation for the theory of evolution, has no explanation itself. Shifting poles. All other theories of the origin of the ice age having failed, there remained an avenue of approach which already early in the discussion was chosen by several geologists: a shift of the terrestrial poles. If for some reason the poles has moved from their original positions, old polar ice would have moved out of the Arctic and Antarctic circles and into new regions. The glacial cover of the ice age could have been the polar ice cap of an earlier epoch. Thus would be explained not only the origin of the ice cover but also the fact that its geographical position did not coincide with the present polar circles. The simplest and most obvious explanation of great secular changes in climate, and of former prevalence of higher temperatures in northern circumpolar regions, would be found in the assumption that the Earth's axis of rotation has not always had the same position, but that it may have changed its position as a result of geological processes, such as extended rearrangement of land and water. For decades in the second half of the 19th century, many scientists participated in the debate centering around this theme. Astronomers and mathematicians asked the geologists what, in their opinion, could have caused such a shifting of the terrestrial poles. The best the geologists could offer was the redisposition of the weight on the surface of the Earth. Sir George Beary, Astronomer Royal, analyzed the question by assuming that the Earth, a perfectly rigid spheroid, a flattened globe, was disturbed in its rotation by a sudden elevation of a mountainous mass in latitudes most favorable for production of a large effect. The axis of rotation would no longer coincide with the axis of figure, and there would be wobbling. Under these circumstances, the axis of rotation would wander in the solid Earth. But it would not wander indefinitely. However, the smallness of the effect would be disappointing. If a mountain mass should be produced equal to 1/1000th part of the mass of the equatorial bulge, which I apprehend is very far above the fact, the shift of the Earth's pole would be only 2 or 3 miles, and this, though it would greatly surprise astronomers, would produce no such changes of climate as those which it is desired to explain. Sir George Darwin, mathematician and cosmologist, the renowned son of an illustrious father, made more thorough calculations on this point. If an ocean bed 15,000 feet deep rose to become a continent the size of Africa 1,100 feet above sea level, and on the other side of the globe an equal area became depressed, the effect would be a shift of the poles by about 2 degrees. However, were the Earth plastic, the poles would wander to a greater extent. There probably never was an upheaval of such magnitude in the history of our Earth. And to produce a deflection of, here, scan a mistake, a deflection that would hardly sensibly affect climate, no less than 1/10th of the entire surface of the Earth would require to be elevated to the height of 10,000 feet. A continent 10 times the size of Europe elevated 2 miles would do little more than bring London to the latitude of Edinburgh, or Edinburgh to the latitude of London. He must be a sanguine geologist indeed who can expect to account for the glaciation of this country, or for the former absence of ice around the poles, by this means. We know perfectly well that since the glacial epoch there have been no changes in the physical geography of the Earth sufficient to deflect the pole 6 miles, far less 6 degrees. J. Evans, a geologist, suggested that the astronomers reconsider their conclusion, on the supposition that the Earth is a shell filled with molten matter. He envisaged the possibility that, under a change of load in the crust. The crust will be forced to alter its position in relation to the axis by as much as 20 degrees. Sir William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, the physicist, took up the issue and retorted that the Earth cannot, as many geologists suppose, be a liquid mass enclosed in only a thin shell of solidified matter. At the surface and for many miles below the surface, the rigidity of the Earth is certainly very much less than that of iron, and therefore at great depths the rigidity must be enormously greater than at the surface. Whatever be its age, we may be quite sure the Earth is solid in its interior, and we must utterly reject any geological hypothesis which assumes the solid Earth to be a shell of 30 or 100, or 500 or 1000 kilometers thickness, resting on an interior liquid mass. Lord Kelvin showed that, if the Earth were a liquid mass covered with a solid crust, the solid crust would yield so freely to the deforming influence of sun and moon, that it would simply carry the waters of the oceans up and down with it, and there would be no sensible tidal rise and fall of water relatively to it. The state of the case is shortly this: the hypothesis of a perfectly rigid crust containing liquid violates physics by assuming preternaturally matter, and violates dynamical astronomy. Lord Kelvin admitted, however, that a larger shifting of the poles would be possible if the Earth had a solid nucleus in the interior separated by a liquid layer from the outer crust. This he regarded as improbable and directed his argument against an Earth with a molten interior. George Darwin supported the views of Lord Kelvin, presenting figures to show that the Earth could not have a fluid nucleus, its rigidity must be at least as great as that of steel. Thus the efforts of the geologists to explain the origin of the ice cover by the shifting of the poles founded on the calculations of the mathematicians. A mathematician made the point clear: mathematicians may seem to geologists almost churlish in their unwillingness to admit a change in the Earth's axis. Geologists scarcely know how much is involved in what they ask. They do not seem to realize the vastness of the Earth's size, or the enormous quantity of her motion. When a mass of matter is in rotation about an axis, it cannot be made to rotate about a new one except by external force. Internal changes cannot alter the axis, only the distribution of the matter and motion about it. If the mass began to revolve about a new axis, every particle would begin to move in a different direction. What is to cause this? Where is the force that could deflect every portion of it, and every particle of the Earth into a new direction of motion? Searching for causes in the Earth itself, the geologists offered a theory concerning changes on the surface of the globe which, as the astronomers calculated, could have displaced the poles, but only to an extent entirely inadequate to account for the ice cover in the Ice Age. The explanation that appeared best to the geologists was rejected by the physicists and astronomers, who for their part could not propose any other satisfactory solution. Further developments showed that tides in the terrestrial crust under the influence of moon and sun, unknown to Lord Kelvin, do exist, though they are minute. This means that the Earth is not perfectly rigid. It was also found that the Earth makes a real wobbling motion. S. C. Chandler, an American astronomer, 1846-1913, explained the wobbling of the Earth as an indication of its being removed from a balanced position. Simon Newcomb, foremost American mathematical astronomer, in his paper On the Periodic Variation of Latitude, wrote, "Chandler's remarkable discovery that the apparent variation in terrestrial latitudes may be accounted for by supposing a revolution of the axis of rotation of the Earth around that of figure, is in such disaccord with the received theory of the Earth's rotation, that, at first, I was disposed to doubt its possibility. However, on reconsideration, he found a theoretical justification. Theory then shows that the axis of rotation will revolve around that of figure, in a period of 306 days and in a direction from west toward east." G. V. Schiaparelli, the Italian astronomer, in his research, pointed out that in the case of displacement the pole of inertia, or of figure, and the new pole of rotation would describe circles around each other, and the Earth would be in a state of strain. The Earth is at present in this condition, and as a result the pole of rotation describes a small circle in 304 days, known as the Eulerian Circle. This phenomenon of wobbling points to a displacement of the terrestrial poles sometime in the past. The question centers, then, on the forces that could have caused such a shift. Schiaparelli wrote, "The permanence of the geographical poles in the very same regions of the Earth cannot yet be considered as incontestably established by astronomical or mechanical arguments. Such permanence may be a fact today, but it remains a matter still to be proven for the preceding ages of the history of the globe." 11. He thought that a series of geological changes could, by their cumulative effect, step by step, destroy the equilibrium of the Earth, on condition that the Earth is not an absolutely rigid body. The possibility of great shifting of the pole is an important element in the discussion of prehistoric climates and the distribution, geographic and chronologic, of ancient organisms. If this possibility is admitted, it will open new horizons for the study of great mechanical revolutions that the crust of the Earth underwent in the past. We cannot imagine, for instance, that the terrestrial equator could take the place of a meridian, without great horizontal tension in some regions, that would open great rifts, and in other regions, horizontal compressions would have taken place, such as are imagined today in order to explain the folding of the strata and formation of mountains. The resistance of the spheroid or the terrestrial globe, flattened at the poles, to a change in position must, in Schiaparelli's opinion, show itself also in the leveling of great areas and the extension of shallow seas, like that of the Baltic and North Seas. He finished by saying, "Our problem, so important from the astronomical and mathematical standpoint, touches the foundations of geology and paleontology. Its solution is tied to the most grandiose events in the history of the Earth." Later observations put the Eulerian, or Chandler's, period at 428 to 429 days. Thus, finally, an eminent astronomer, after a thorough examination of the problem, went over to the side of the geologist. However, he reasoned in a circle. The geological changes would cause the terrestrial poles to move from their places, and the motion of the poles from their places would cause geological and climatic changes. A gradual and slow displacement of the poles or a tilting of the axis would explain the geographical position of the ice in the past, but it would not account for other phenomena observed, such as the extent of the glacial cover and the suddenness with which it enveloped the Earth. Agassiz realized this, and in support of the idea that the ice ages came suddenly, he quoted Cuvier. Cuvier died before the ice age theory was promulgated, but he understood that the climate must have altered suddenly in order to encase the large quadrupeds of Siberia in ice as soon as they were killed, and to preserve their bodies from decay since then. Therefore, wrote Cuvier in prophetic anticipation of the debate that has been renewed for over 100 years, down to our times, all hypotheses of a gradual cooling of the Earth, or a slow variation of the inclination or position of the terrestrial axis, are inadequate. The sliding continents. The geological changes in the distribution of land and water being inadequate to explain the shifting of the poles, the problem is thrown back once more into the domain of astronomy. But before we ask, what forces in the solar system could have displaced the terrestrial axis, we shall discuss a theory that has for over 3 decades occupied the minds of geologists, climatologists, and devolutionists, the theory of the shifting continents. Instead of the poles shifting, according to Wegener's theory, the continents drift and pass one after the other through the southern and northern polar regions. In August 1950, the British Association for the Advancement of Science devoted the sessions of its annual convention to debate on the question, is the theory of the continental drift, slide, right or wrong? There were many defenders of the theory and as many opponents. The theory was then put to a vote. The result was an even division between yea and nay. The chairman was entitled to cast the deciding vote but abstained, only through the fortuitous circumstance that the presiding officer was a conscientious, or undecided, person was the sanctification of continental drift averted. The theory of drifting continents, debated since the 1920s, has its starting point in the similarity of the shapes of the coastlines of Brazil and Africa. This similarity, or, better, complementation, plus some early faunal and floral affinities suggested to Professor Alfred Wegener of Graz in Styria, that in an early geological age these two continents, South America and Africa, were one land mass. But since animal and vegetable affinities could also be found in other parts of the world, Wegener conjectured that all continents and islands were once a single land mass that in various epochs divided and drifted apart. Those who do not subscribe to the theory of continental drift continue to explain the affinity of plants and animals by land bridges or former land connections between continents and also between continents and islands. In order that continents might move, it is claimed that there must be a basic difference between the composition of the Earth's crust that is exposed in land masses and that which exists on the bottom of the ocean. The theory of drifting continents is grounded on the increasingly well-proven doctrine of isostasy or the flotation of the crust of the Earth on plastic magma. A new nomenclature was introduced. The land masses or the outer crust are called sissile, an abbreviation of silicon and aluminium, two of the elements predominant in the composition of terrestrial rocks. The substratum is called sima, an abbreviation of silicon and magnesium, there being a good reason for believing that the rocks forming the substratum, bottom, of the ocean bed are more basic in composition and contain a large proportion of magnesia, magnesium oxide. It is also assumed that the sima underlies the seal of the continents and, possessing the plastic properties of sealing wax, permits the continents to drift. Besides accounting for the correspondence between the coastal features of East and South America and Western Africa and between those of other continents, and certain affinities in the animal and plant kingdoms, the theory of drift tries to account for several geological phenomena, all in need of explanation. 1. The cause of the ice ages, 2. The distribution of coal beds, and 3. The formation of mountains. According to Wegener, mountainous crests rose, in the movement of the land, on the forward side of the floating continents, meeting some resistance in its motion on elastic sima, the seal formed elevations. Thus, when South America moved away from Africa, an elevation was raised on the side turned to the Pacific Ocean, the Andes. If, from the beginning, there was but one land mass, there could have been only one ocean, too, and, according to Wegener, the only ocean was the Pacific. The Atlantic is a later formation, and its bottom cannot be of sima, like that of the Pacific, but is built of stretched seal. Sufficient proof of the difference in composition of the substrata of the Atlantic and the Pacific has not yet been adduced. The occurrence in an early glacial period of ice cover in lands now in tropical and subtropical regions is explained by the supposition that these lands were once in the Antarctic. However, their extent is so great that if all of them were joined around the South Pole, many parts that have signs of the Ice Age would still be too remote from the pole. The theory assumes, therefore, that these lands occupied in succession the position of the Antarctic continent today, each in its turn passing through a glacial period. The signs of glaciation in Africa, India, Australia, and South America are accounted for by the successive sliding of these continents through the southern polar region. A similar explanation is offered for the origin of the Ice Age in the Northern Hemisphere, at a much more recent date, when the land masses of North America and Europe wandered close to the North Pole. The North Pole is charted on various points on the globe, in the Pacific, in the Canadian Arctic Archipelago, in Greenland, in Spitsbergen, all in succession during the Pleistocene, or recent Ice Age. The coal beds in northern countries, among them Alaska and Spitsbergen, are dated by Wegener from the time when these lands occupied tropical or subtropical belts, on their passage from the southern hemisphere to the northern. If a theory can explain the origin of mountains, the cause of the Ice Ages, the coal beds in higher latitudes, and certain common characteristics of the fauna and flora of continents separated by oceans, then the correspondence in the contours of the Brazilian and West African coasts truly served as a clue to the solution of major problems in geology and climatology. However, There are facts that strongly challenge this hypothesis. The minute difference between the gravitational pulls to which the crust is subjected in higher latitudes and closer to the equator was offered by Wegener's the motive force in the drift of continents. But Harold Jeffreys, a British cosmologist, computed that this force is 100 billion tunes too weak to produce the effect. There is therefore not the slightest reason to believe that bodily displacements of continents through the lithosphere, the crust, are possible.